Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Wednesday, September 17th, friends, welcome to the show. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. In the wake of Charlie Kirk's killing, some on the political right have been calling for a crackdown on the political left, and they've also been calling for consequences for folks who've said things that they find offensive or crass about Kirk and his assassination. So it started this whole conversation, this recurring conversation about hate speech, free speech, and what we as a society should tolerate. We're going to talk about it today on the show with a couple of great guests. We have a question for you. We would love to hear your thoughts on this topic. What should be the consequences for so-called hate speech? Ignore it? More speech? Should folks get fired? Arrested? Give us a call. 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
Yeah, so much to talk about on this topic because there's so much speech swirling around, so much escalation of it. I look forward to hearing our callers. This is always a listener-driven show. And so, we have a legal expert here who's going to talk about First Amendment law, so many things. And so I look forward to hearing from you again. What do you think should be the consequences for so-called hate speech? And we gave you a list of options there. There could be others. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. Trio of news stories.
Start us off, Cherry.
Yeah, the Trump administration is slated to substantially alter the president's house in Independence Park right here in Philadelphia. That's according to new reporting from the New York Times. The president's house, if you didn't know, is located at 6th and Market Streets. It's an exhibit that memorializes 9 people enslaved by George Washington. The site was a target of a March executive order signed by President Donald Trump that required a review of federal historic sites that disparage Americans past or present ahead of the nation's 250th anniversary celebration. And if you don't know this, I mean, the president's house was installed around 2010. After years of advocacy by groups like Avenging Our Ancestors Coalition, the leader of that group, Michael Cord, a prominent Philadelphia attorney, told the Philadelphia Inquirer that he was outraged by the Trump administration's attempt to sanitize American history. And he said, quote, "A substantial alteration or even minimal alteration is historical blasphemy." And right now it's unclear what specific displays at the president's house will be changed or how they will be changed. But today, September 17th, was the deadline set by the Trump administration to change or alter displays targeted by that executive order. So I'm sure more news will be coming as far as what will happen.
Yeah, and we've talked about this before because it was pretty clear where it was heading from the start. You mentioned that from the moment that executive order was issued, Independence Hall, Independence Mall, was called out specifically. Mm-hmm. So we knew the federal government was going to be looking at sites around here, and it became quickly apparent that the president's house was going to be a focus of this. And, you know, it's feels very much like a sign of the times.
Yeah.
It feels like a flattening of American history, a sanitization. It's hard to argue with that framing of it. And, like I said, just not surprised.
Yeah.
You know, just it feels like this has been forecasted, and it doesn't change what happened in the past. The past still happened. I believe people are still going to learn.
And you're a history buff, historian in many ways. And
I'm not a historian in any way.
Love history though, and this is something that you study and care a lot about. And so, you know, and we're talking about free speech today. And you know, people disagree on different viewpoints of history. And so, yeah. Sign of the times.
Story number two. Some Philadelphia food truck owners claim the city retaliated against them after they testified against a new city curfew law. Mm-hmm. These allegations detailed in a recent Inquirer story. A pair of food truck owners testified last week in city council against this curfew law, which forces businesses in several parts of the city to close by 11 p.m. or face fines. Mm-hmm. The business owner said, hey, this is going to hurt our business, et cetera, et cetera. You should not enforce this law. Then the food truck owners say within hours of their testimony, they received visits from city officials. Vendor Edward Bonilla's truck was actually towed when officials discovered his vehicle registration had expired. A libertarian law firm sent a letter to the city threatening to sue, suggesting that these men were targeted for exercising their free speech rights. Hey, there's that phrase again. The city department that oversees LNI denies all of this, says that all the enforcement was pre-planned before the city council testimony. This is all just a coincidence.
Yeah. This has definitely been a flashpoint topic in the Kensington community and in the surrounding neighborhoods. I mean, these food truck operators say, you know, what did their businesses have to do with crime? Because all of this has been a crackdown on some of the crime in Kensington. And they had been organizing against this 11 p.m. curfew, and they say it's been costing them thousands of dollars in sales. They had to lay off workers. And they said, look, you know, our customers are SEPTA workers who work night shift. They're, you know, police officers. And so, you know, they've had to deal with these fines and things like that. So and meanwhile, city council, the member who represents that area has said, look, this curfew is necessary. They need to clean up the crime in Kensington. So we'll see what happens. But this has been a flashpoint topic. I mean, every time you turn around, I live in East Kensington and people are talking about this.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I feel bad for these guys and their business. I'm going to need to see a little bit more evidence to prove that there was like a coordinated connection. Retaliation, because this sort of assumes that the city government within hours can coordinate among various agencies and raid people's businesses. I'm like, I've seen city government in action, and usually it takes more than a few hours.
They're giving them a lot of credit.
Mm-hmm. And I also point out that these men had already been public about their opposition to the legislation. It wasn't like this. Their opposition was revealed via the city council testimony that happened last week. It feels a little bit to me like the law firm is trying to take advantage of a coincidence to drum up some publicity around this. But I'm willing for more evidence to be presented and for me to be proven wrong.
Yeah,
it just doesn't. It didn't quite pass the smell test for me the first time around. But of course, I do sympathize with the plight.
But lawsuits don't always mean an actual case. So we'll see.
And it wasn't even a lawsuit. It was a threat of a lawsuit. Which is another
nothing.
You didn't even file anything. You sent an angry letter that found its way into the media somehow.
Somehow. We're talking about it. That's what makes
it. Yeah, exactly. That's why you do it.
Yeah. Third story. Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor was in Philadelphia Tuesday night at the Free Library. Justice Sotomayor was promoting her new children's book, Just Shine, which is a tribute to her mother, Celine. And by the way, I had the pleasure of doing the interview with the Associate Justice. And I'll say she was lively. She was personable, walking through the audience, collecting hugs from all the children that were there. There were a few big takeaways, though. You know, she talked about the fact that she has some deep disagreements with some members of the court, but also deep respect for her colleagues. And she went out of her way to say that they are a family. And she even had some nice things to say about Justice Clarence Thomas, who she has had the deepest disagreements with. She also talked about her dissents, which have been very powerful of late. And she says her dissents are done with purpose and for different audiences. She said a lot of people feel a lot of despair and loss of hope. And the dissents are meant for folks to know that somebody on the court hears them and sees their plight. She also says that in some cases, the dissents are a roadmap for politicians, for activists and others to remedy the situation that is being dealt with. The final big takeaway from her conversation was that American citizens need to participate in democracy in order for it to work. And also, if you want change, everybody has to do their part. She also says that people should read the actual opinions, not just the headlines, but read the opinions, read the concurrences, read the dissents. So it was a pretty cool moment.
Wait, she thinks we're going to do that?
She was hoping.
I don't got that kind of time. I'm sorry.
She was hoping that people.
It's a nice hope.
Versus just reading the headlines. We're in this, you know, society where people just read the tweets. But I'll have to say personally, as someone who practiced law, someone who's a court nerd and a journalist, this was truly an honor to meet the first Latina on the U.S. Supreme Court.
How nervous were you?
Extremely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you ever been that nervous before an interview?
Not really. And I will tell you, she said she gets really nervous, too, until she sits in the seat.
Really?
She said she said her knees knock and she gets really, really nervous. But once she sits down, it all goes away. And I have the same thing.
It's comforting to know that someone like that gets nervous.
Yes.
Before speaking in front of an audience.
Yes, she gets very
because they always the justices seem so unflappable. Like all of them, honestly.
They do. But it was, I mean, by the way, Justice Amy Coney Barrett is also out and about. She's promoting her book, Listening to the Law. She'll be at the National Constitution Center tonight in conversation with Jeffrey Rosen, the CEO.
Wow. Big Supreme Court week.
It is.
In Philadelphia. Supreme Court has set a standard for free speech in this country. We're going to
talk
about it
that.
On the other side of the break. Stay tuned to Studio 2, right here on WHYY.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Over the last 5 years or so, the political pendulum on free speech has swung with dizzying speed. Conservative activists once railed against liberal cancel culture. Now, in the wake of Charlie Kirk's death, they have struck a markedly different tone.
There have been calls to dox people who celebrated Kirk's death or even mentioned his more controversial views. Senior administration officials say they're preparing to crack down on the left and so-called hate speech. And on the left, there's been a noticeable embrace of free speech protections, an embrace that perhaps wasn't so strong 5 years ago.
Through it all, we find ourselves in a familiar place, debating exactly what we mean when we talk about free speech. Do we really want to tolerate views we find repugnant, or is free speech just another partisan wedge? Let's talk about it with Will Creeley, legal director at the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. Will, it's nice to see you again.
Thank you, Avi. Thank you, Cherry. We've got a lot to talk about.
Oh, yeah.
We do. And for all of you listening at home, on the road, and elsewhere, our questions of the day are this. What should be the consequences for so-called hate speech? Should we just ignore it? Should there be more speech? Should folks get fired? How about arrested? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, share this video and then leave your comments in the chat.
Before air, Will, we were talking about the fact that you've been working for FIRE, I think, since 2006, right?
Yeah.
And one way, I guess, to measure what's going on is to look at the volume of complaints you guys are fielding, you know, this year versus 5 years ago versus 10 years ago versus 15 years ago. So what does it look like right now, Will?
We're completely inundated. Right now, my colleagues are probably a little mad at me because I'm not doing the work of going through the, the tranche of submissions. We've received requests for help from across the country. It's hard to count. On Thursday and Friday, I think we're receiving a submission either through news reporting or people writing to us. It felt like about every 15 minutes.
And that you've never seen anything like that.
It's a lot. The most ready parallel in my mind is the summer of 2020, the summer after George Floyd's murder. That felt like the busiest we'd been. And I think some of our internal data showed it was. And this feels kind of like a redux of that, except with the partisan polls reversed.
Yeah, I want to ask about that comparison because the reaction to the murder of George Floyd was very stark. People were calling folks out, just like the death of Charlie Kirk. What comparisons and what differences do you see in those two reactions?
Well, first of all, obviously the political valence of each is different. I mean, I've been joking. I'm old enough to remember when the right didn't want cancel culture and the left was saying things like words have consequences. I'm seeing almost verbatim the exact same quotes from either side. So as I always tell my attorneys working for a nonpartisan nonprofit, our job is just to stay in the same place, not to get pulled one direction, not to get pulled the other. That's what the First Amendment requires, freedom of speech for all. And the truth is, Cherry, that every time we lose a public figure, someone's going to stand up and say, I'm glad they're gone. I didn't like them. Here's all the terrible things they did. We had, in the wake of George Floyd's murder, a student who was suspended for saying he just had his first, drug-free month, a month afterwards. People were outraged. And it's okay to be outraged, but to have those kinds of consequences at a public university to be suspended for protected expression, that's a problem. And right now, we're seeing sitting U.S. senators calling for the termination of faculty at public universities. That's a plain First Amendment violation. We're seeing those professors get fired.
Yeah.
Let me read this comment from Gil. This is going to get to the heart of a lot of things here. Gil's very critical of us today. Gil says, I am saddened, no, infuriated at the insistence of supposedly neutral news media to adopt the deceptive frames of the far right. Your question today, what is your attitude toward hate speech? Unmindful of the fact that the Trump administration is using the term to describe all expression that doesn't align with their party line. Calling out Charlie Kirk for actual statements he has made as public record is not hate speech, it's free speech. Mm-hmm. So, Will, are we making a false equivalency here?
Gil is exactly right insofar as there is there's no hate speech exception to the First Amendment. If mm-hmm. I had a quarter every time somebody said hate speech isn't free speech, I'd be rich. I wouldn't be working for a nonprofit. I'd be, you know, hanging out somewhere else. The Trump administration, to Gil's point, is using the term hate speech in a way that blows my mind. When I spoke to left-leaning audiences for the past 20 years, they say, isn't there a hate speech exception? I say, no, and I'll tell you why there isn't. Because imagine the person you disagree with most politically, say Donald Trump, last 10 years. Imagine President Trump had the authority to decide what was and was not hate speech. Well, that's exactly what's happening now. I feel like my hypothetical has come to life. I feel a little guilty for speaking into existence. You got the Attorney General Pam Bondi saying hate speech is not free speech, and we will go after. We will target.
But I think the point from the folks on the left is it's that word hate. So whether or not it's legal or illegal, this is maybe more a moral ethical question, but they're looking at that word hate, and they're saying the stuff that we were criticizing was people being like really hateful and mean.
Right.
And what's happening now, it at least doesn't feel to them like that.
It
feels like statement of the record, you know?
There's a professor at Florida Atlantic who is, terminated. It's hard to keep up for just retweeting past statements of Charlie Kirk.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
For folks on the right, they think, wait a second, one of our shining stars, one of our lodestars for the conservative movement has just been assassinated in broad daylight. Now is not the time to talk about this. And that kind of debate, to your point, Avi, about what's moral and what's ethical, will always rage on. That's why there is no legal exception for hate speech, because all of us will disagree on it. One person's statement of fact will be another person's improper, impolitic statement. Not now, too soon, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I want to read this comment. Ronald says, hate speech gets you all of the above. Hate speech will also get you what happened to Charlie and others. You have the freedom to say what you want, but none of us are free from the consequences of those actions. And I want to go to the purpose of the First Amendment, because a lot of people forget and they don't understand. They get mad and they say you should be punished. There should be consequences to whatever you have to say. The First Amendment doesn't necessarily protect you from all consequences, but there are protections. Explain what those parameters are.
Yeah, that's a great question. Let's break it down. So if you're a public employee, you have a First Amendment right when you're speaking off the clock on a matter of public concern. The assassination of Charlie Kirk certainly qualifies. There's no official party line in the United States. All of us have the right to make up our own minds as citizens about what we think about what just happened, what we think about who the man was. So you have a right to get on social media and say, I think he was a racist, or I think he was a hero. That's fine. If you're on the clock, different story. Mm-hmm. Unless you are a public university faculty and you're using in your teaching and scholarship, no First Amendment protections. Now that's public employees. Private employers have much more leeway to punish employees if they say something that's not good for the brand or otherwise just isn't a message the company wants to send. So now we're talking about norms, and here's where things get a little tricky. Mm. My organization wants to push for a culture of free expression where you don't have to choose between having a job and having an opinion. Listen, if I come on this station right now and I say, you know what, actually, free speech is a scam. Let me just tell you, the last people you want to donate to is my organization. I'm going to go back to my office and they're going to tell me to pack up.
Yeah.
That's fine. But I don't want to get to a place where we have this kind of national snitch culture where the vice president is saying report people with the wrong opinion to their employers. That's a message that is chilling by design, and it's going to result in a situation where all of us bite our tongues unless we agree with.
And that's my question to you, Will. I mean, when you have government actors, I think the governor of Texas actually called for someone to be expelled from a university. When you have government actors and elected officials calling for people to be fired, does that cross a line because they are in a government seat?
I would argue it does in both contexts, right? So the governor of Texas, Governor Abbott, is saying a student at Texas State University who mocked the assassination should be expelled. that student has a First Amendment claim. He now can say that he fears retaliation for his protected expression, and that chilling effect is grounds for a First Amendment claim. The other thing we're seeing where the government is leaning on private companies, there's a representative in Congress who just introduced a bill that would require social media companies to pull all posts, quote-unquote, celebrating the murder of Charlie Kirk. That's not going to go anywhere. But even just the idea that government actors, elected officials, can push private companies into changing speech, that's also a First Amendment violation. Supreme Court reaffirmed that just last term. So, yeah, it's a lot of things going on right now.
I think you alluded earlier, Will, to, you didn't, not by name, but you alluded to something that Vice President J.D. Vance said recently about what you called snitch culture. I just want to hear that clip, actually, from J.D. Vance. Can we clear that up? This is what J.D. Vance said recently after the killing of Charlie Kirk.
Civil society, Charlie understood this well, is not just something that flows from the government. It flows from each and every one of us. It flows from all of us. So when you see someone celebrating Charlie's murder, call them out in hell. Call their employer. We don't believe in political violence, but we do believe in civility.
I mean, so what do you make of that, Will? Because this is moving beyond what the law says or the guarantees of the First Amendment. This is about what we should do as fellow citizens when we see someone say something that we feel is repugnant. And maybe they work at an organization in a position of power, and we think someone with this level of judgment should not have that position. You know, I could read some specific examples, but like a DC Comics writer had her series canceled after she said, "Thoughts and prayers, you Nazi blank. Mm-hmm. Hope the bullet's okay after touching Charlie Kirk." And then the DC said, "We don't want to work with this person anymore." Do you see a problem with that?
I think the private employer has the right to make that decision, mm-hmm. to be clear.
Yeah, the right is different right. than what should they
what
do.
What should happen.
Yeah.
Here's my problem. Again, if all of us have to worry about a social media push to get us fired, if we say something that the vice president doesn't look like, then that right to free expression starts becoming a little illusory. It starts becoming something that is only accepted in a courtroom. It doesn't become something that we live with in our real lives. And that's what I'm worried about. It's corrosive to our culture of free expression.
Some people say it's corrosive to allow violent language to go unchecked. What do you say to them?
I would understand. Like, I'm with the vice president when he says, call them out. That's great. You know, mm-hmm. if you don't like what somebody says, the answer, call them out. That's civil liberties 101.
More speech.
You mm-hmm. got it. And that's fine. I mean, Charlie Kirk was famous for that. He was a person who seemed to thrive off of going into environments where nobody agreed with him. He spent his last few minutes answering questions from folks who disagreed with his views on trans rights, on immigration. If the story remained, hey, Charlie Kirk was somebody who was willing to mix it up, say provocative things, and mm-hmm. get as good as he gives, that's a story of free speech. When it's a story about the vice president says employers should be called and nobody should feel comfortable airing these views in public, I think we've gone too far.
Yeah, let me remind everybody what the question of the day is. What should be the consequences for so-called hate speech? Should you ignore it? Should there be more speech? Should folks get fired? How about arrested? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, leave those comments in the chat. We have Celine from Malvern on the line. Celine, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Well, I'd like to see if you could give some more examples of what hate speech is. And I never heard of Charlie Kirk because I'm a Democrat and that's how I vote. And I listen to people with those opinions. So I did see a bit of a video of his after he was killed. And in the video, he said that to protect the Second Amendment, that some people would have to die. And I started thinking about the children from Sandy Hook, the little 6, 7, and 8-year-old kids, and what their parents must think when they hear somebody like Charlie Kirk say something like that. Like, some people will have to die to protect the Second Amendment. So I don't know. Is that hate speech? It's horrible speech.
Yeah.
But I don't know the difference.
Yeah.
So can you comment on that, please?
Thank you. That's Celine from Malvern. And of course, this is a question a lot of people have been asking online. Paul says, define hate speech specifically and clearly because the government sure can't. So, Will.
That's it.
What is it?
Paul and Celine are both right. You can't define hate speech. My version of hate speech, what I find hateful, is going to look a lot different than the the presidents or the vice presidents. And that's why we don't have a hate speech exception, because none of us could agree on what its parameters would be. I should note there are a couple of categorical exceptions to the First Amendment that do include hateful speech,
right?
True threats, right?
Yeah.
Speech that is directed to putting someone, a specific person, in fear of bodily harm or death. That's not protected. It's a narrow bar. It has to be met by facts, but that's not protected. Incitement, speech that's directed to and likely to result in imminent lawless action, also not protected.
Yeah.
But those are high bars.
And I want to talk about the incitement, because we've heard, you know, our lawmakers and others on the right specifically saying that some of these comments about Charlie Kirk that celebrated his death, or maybe even not really celebrated, but just didn't mourn it in a way that some people may feel like the situation called for. What exactly is incitement? Can you give us some examples so that people really understand where the line is from just speaking and saying whatever to really calling on or calling for violence?
The key word is imminence. There's a case called Hess v. Indiana, where you have a student protester during the height of the anti-Vietnam War protests. And the protest, he's involved in street protests. Things are getting a little dicey. The cops are coming in. And he gets up in front of the crowd and he says, "We'll take the effing street later." He's arrested for inciting violence. Case goes up to the Supreme Court. And the court says, well, it lacks imminence, right? He said later. By definition, he said not now. But if he had said, right now, everybody, let's go, we're going to fight the cops, that's it, now's our moment of truth, that looks like incitement. But it has to be intended to and likely to. The crowd's got to agree. They got to be juiced up and ready to go. Imminent lawless action.
Yeah, interesting.
Let's bring in another caller. This is Dan from Ardmore on the line. Hey, Dan, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My comment is regarding the discussion of cancel culture. So it seems to me that this is something that the Republicans invented many years ago and are now complaining that it's being done to them. Some examples, you know, I think of Colin Kaepernick. I think of the whole Bud Light thing that happened when the Republicans decided to cancel that company. And if I go way back, I mean, think of when the gay marriage issue was on the table, and bands like the Dixie Chicks got canceled by the Republicans because they didn't like where they came out. So this is, oh, and, you know, I think of Chris Christie getting canceled for having the audacity to accept federal funding when a hurricane hit his state. So, you know, this is something that the Republicans have done for many, many years, and they're just now complaining that it's being done back to them. I don't like the tit for tat, but I also don't like an unfair conversation.
Yeah.
So is it an unfair conversation, Will? Are we having an unfair conversation? Because, there certainly are historical examples of people on the right trying to, through commerce or other means, silence dissenting viewpoints.
Sure. I mean, there are buckets of examples on either side. You have a First Amendment right to boycott. Mm-hmm. Think about anti-apartheid, or today, folks in the pro-Palestinian movement, the boycott, divest, sanctions movement. Both of those are fully protected. If I wanted to start a movement and say, these folks employ somebody who celebrated Charlie Kirk's murder, let's not shop there anymore, that's protected. That is you know, legitimate political organizing protected by the First Amendment. I think to the caller's point, there is a lot of free speech when it's convenient, and authority when we have the power.
Let me ask you about something that members of the administration, high-ranking members, have said is coming in the coming months or maybe even weeks. They've talked about this idea of sanctioning or disrupting nonprofits that they believe foment, facilitate, or engage in violence. And they're talking specifically about NGOs on the political left. Legally, what do you think they would have to prove in order to, you know, target those organizations in some form or fashion? Are there loopholes they could use that really circumvent the free speech issue but allow them still to revoke nonprofit status, things like that? I mean, what do you see as the battleground here?
Well, Avi, you've gone to the heart of the matter. This is what scares the hell out of me. The cultural stuff is going to sort itself out one way or the other. We see it every time somebody is killed in a tragic way, whether it's Barbara Bush or Queen Elizabeth. But the administration right now seems to be using the murder of Charlie Kirk as pretext, as grounds, justification for enacting the type of crackdown on political opposition that I haven't seen in 20 years of doing this work. I'm waiting to see the text of this rumored executive order, but to your good question as to what the authority might be, I can't think of any. We have not seen any evidence linking this individual.
Well, I guess the loophole might be, oh, we found something in your books,
right?
Blah, blah, blah. We're revoking your tax-exempt status.
But the loss, I understand it. I'm just a humble First Amendment lawyer, not a tax lawyer. The loss, I understand it, is because we looked into this a few months ago, is that the president does not have the authority to order that revocation from IRS officials. And IRS officials, I think, are barred by law. So I understand it reading this New York Times piece last night, from taking action on those orders.
They could say it, but not do it. And they could do it, but not say it.
Yeah.
Isn't that a possibility?
I will put nothing past the current administration.
And I have a follow-up on this point, because I was reading an article recently, and they were talking about during the Obama administration, the IRS did crack down on right-leaning nonprofits, calling out specifically Tea Party organizations, mm-hmm. and did all sorts of onerous audits on these organizations, something that people on the right are still upset about, even though the Obama administration didn't call for that. Would you say to people from the right who say, look, this was done under previous Democratic, administrations to the right?
We know about that. We opposed it back then. We were concerned about it, signed court filings expressing our concern about it. So I think it's a serious problem. Right now in this country, we seem to be engaged in this kind of nuclear-grade whataboutism. Like, well, what we're doing is justified because of what you did. And what you did is justifying this. And I'm tired of it. You know, we have to get back to first principles, where you're allowed to disagree with the administration, be it blue or red or whatever.
Yeah, I want to sort of have us play this comment from Attorney General Pam Bondi, who spoke on Katie Miller's podcast Monday about going after hate speech. By the way, Katie Miller is the wife of Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller. Take a listen to what she had to say.
Do you see more law enforcement going after these groups who are using hate speech and putting cuffs on people so we show them that some action is better than no action?
We will absolutely target you, go after you, if you are targeting anyone with hate speech, anything. And that's across the aisle.
And by the way, the next day, AG Bondi clarified that it's only hate speech that crosses the line into threats of violence that she's targeting. But you mentioned that the Supreme Court recently sort of reaffirmed the lines of, the protection of free speech. I mean, this is a very conservative court. Are there any indications that that line could shift and that the types of things that AG, Bondi is talking about would become okay?
I don't see anything like that. Happily, that's the good news. I don't see anything like that from this current court. I did see a wave of criticism from the right online of the attorney general for that, frankly, constitutionally ignorant comment. That's not something I would expect, a second-year law student to say, let alone the sitting attorney general of the United States. And she did, as you say, try to clean it up. She walked it back the next day. To Avi's point from a minute ago, the real concern, we can have debates about cancel culture, mm-hmm. norms, and ethics, mm-hmm. but the real concern is when the administration starts using the power of the state, or the governor starts using the power of the state to get people punished for having dissenting views. And that's what we're seeing right now too often, and with threats of more on the way.
Yeah, we're about to go to a break, but just real quick, this is maybe a silly legal question. The fact that she's now on the record saying that, is that something you can use in briefs and responses and a part of your sort of, legal battle here that seems to be coming?
I would be surprised if it didn't end up somewhere. It'll be
Exhibit
in a complaint.
Exhibit A. Yeah.
Going to be in a citation. Okay, so keep those calls and comments coming. Victor says, oh, what a slippery slope. I think it's perfectly fair game to try to expose what you think of as hate speech. And if that leads to job loss, then you call an employment lawyer. But what is hate speech? Who gets to define the parameters? Many would argue that simply saying free Palestine is hate speech. Send your comments to studio2@whyy.org. You can also call 888-477-9499. We asked you today, what should be the consequences for so-called hate speech? Ignore it, more speech, should folks get fired, arrested, etc.? We'll continue to answer those questions on the other side of this break and bring in another guest. This is Studio 2 on WHYY. And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arend.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We have been talking about free speech and cancel culture in connection to some conservative voices demanding that people be fired or investigated for a speech shared in the wake of Charlie Kirk's murder.
We have been talking with Will Creeley, legal director at the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. Now let's bring in columnist and lawyer Christine Flowers. Christine, welcome back to Studio 2.
Hi, Avi. Hi, Cherry. Good to talk to you again.
Yes, good to see you. And Christine, before we get your take on cancel culture and free speech, I want to remind our listeners and viewers that our phone lines and chats are still open. Our question of the day is this: what should be the consequences for so-called hate speech? Ignore it. More speech. Should folks get fired? How about arrested? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, keep those comments coming in the chat.
Yeah, Christine, I've sensed that on legal matters, you agree a lot with Will. But then when it comes to what private companies should or shouldn't do, or what the consequences should be for someone who works for a private employer, maybe there's some disagreement there. So what do you see as sort of the red line, and what do you think is sort of an okay version of policing speech?
Well, first of all, this is a fantastic conversation, and I've been listening to Will, and I do agree with virtually everything that he has said from a legal perspective. As a lawyer and as a columnist, I'm a bit, not, I wouldn't say torn, but I have different perspectives. I used to work for a newspaper that let me go, that fired me, partly because of my opinions, also because of my engagement with some of the readers. And they had every right to do so because it was a private organization. And while I wasn't happy that they did it, I understood, as an attorney, I understood that they had every right to do it. Would I have liked them to give me a little bit more rope to hang myself with? Yeah, absolutely. But they were completely entitled to fire me, because it was a private organization. Now, government entities cannot do that easily because of the First Amendment. We also don't live in a police state where speech will get you arrested or, in the worst situation, killed. I had an asylum hearing yesterday at the Newark Asylum Office with an individual who is seeking asylum because he was thrown into jail because of speeches that he was giving. So I see this in a different way, I think, than many who say, no, you know, speech is free and everyone should be able to enter the marketplace of ideas. Absolutely. No one should be punished at a criminal level because of speech. At the same time, speech has consequences, and free speech is not exactly, it doesn't mean unfettered speech. So, for example, if my boss, the individual that I work for right now, found that some of my commentaries on immigration were harming our practice, he would be 100% entitled, authorized, justified in getting rid of me.
Well, there's a difference, though, Christine, between entitled and should they do it. You know what I mean?
And I guess my question for you, Christine, is what protections should workers have to their off-duty speech? I mean, should there be any protection at all? And who decides where that line is? And we're talking about private employers here.
Exactly. And for me, that's easy. It's a case-by-case situation. It's with the employer. You are at your job by the grace of the employer. The employer doesn't need to employ you. Again, as I said, I know that. I knew that. It happened to me. So I find those who are saying, oh, well, you know, it's punishing someone for having an opinion. You're not being punished because you have an opinion. You've expressed that opinion.
And my follow-up to you, Christine, is this: when you have people who are elected, who are leaning on private organizations to fire someone, does that cross the line in your mind?
Absolutely. What Pam Bondi did, as an attorney and as a conservative, I was embarrassed for Pam Bondi when she came out and said that we're coming after you and that we're going to prosecute you for hate speech. That clearly,
but not the prosecution, but the calling on employers to fire someone, like J.D. Vance, the vice president, has called on folks to do.
That's wrong, too. That's absolutely, that is just another form of government intervention, government putting their thumb on the scale. And I oppose that in the strongest of terms. This government should absolutely have no engagement or involvement in telling private organizations what to do. But if the private organization decides to do it, I applaud them. Mm. I you do what you need to do to protect your business interests.
Yeah, and obviously reputation is such a big part mm-hmm. of a business interest, Will. And I do wonder if you could go too far in sort of promoting this culture of free speech where businesses now feel compelled right. to employ someone that's actively damaging them. I'm thinking of the case of the PR staffer for the Carolina Panthers NFL team who posted some things about Charlie Kirk and then had the Wu-Tang Clan song Protect Your Neck
right.
playing in the background, which is a pretty obvious reference to what happened to him. Why should the Panthers feel compelled to continue employing that individual?
I guess I'm making a larger normative argument right. here. Mm-hmm.
But why should the norms allow that, I guess? Do you think the norms should allow that?
I think that social media is still pretty new in our cultural yeah. bloodstream. And I think that if we can push to a place where we extend grace and people are allowed to say dumb things and make mistakes and be condemned, but also be employable in some aspects, it maybe not for the Panthers, but maybe for the Hornets. I don't know. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I'm making an admittedly a normative argument. We are in complete agreement, my colleague and I here, and with regard to what's legal. But
yeah.
I'm trying to say, let's extend
the squishier conversation that was what we as a society should tolerate. Will, and you're drawing a pretty big circle here.
Drawing a pretty big circle.
Okay.
Here.
And I want to follow up with that, Will, because and you too, Christine, because it seems like this is one of the first times that we're really having a conversation about what the rules are. Should there be rules? Because at the end of the day, most organizations don't tell you what you can and can't say. And you don't find out what you can't say until you get the pink slip.
That's right.
And so, I mean, should we be sparking conversation about some of the guidelines, some of the parameters here? Will, Christine, weigh in. Will?
We have had that conversation often. I always remind my colleagues, especially my new colleagues, my interns, my clerks, don't tweet anything that you wouldn't feel comfortable saying on the front page of New York Times, because
yeah.
that's the world you're living in. But at the same time, while retaining my right as a private employer to fire an employee who comes out and says, you know what, actually, I hate this organization, whatever, I do want to kind of push bit by bit for a place where we understand that folks are going to have different opinions. We had a caller earlier said, didn't know who Charlie Kirk was, only listens to people who have basically the same opinions as she does. That's fine. That's an individual choice, certainly protected. But I think one way to get past the intense balkanization, the polarization we feel right now, is to understand that folks out there have different opinions, and that's okay.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people in the comments bringing up specific examples of cases where they feel like this is incitement. This is really hateful speech. Mm-hmm. And like, why should we tolerate this, or why should it be legal? Margaret says, was it free speech or incitement for the rioters who broke into the Capitol building on January 6th to chant kill Mike Pence? Frank says, so Jews will not replace us was not hate speech that led to Heather Heyer's murder, talking about what happened in Charlottesville. How about the hatred and calls for sexual violence against Greta Thunberg when she was a minor? Lots of different examples, Will, but people feel like, how is this not at least close to the line?
First one is unprotected. I would say once you're in the Capitol, you're already
yeah.
breaking the law.
Exactly.
Kill Mike Pence. The Jews will not replace us. Yeah, it's hateful speech, probably protected. And the way I would might qualify that is if there's a Jewish student in front of these torch-bearing folks.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now we're talking about true threats or intimidation. Last one is just, calls for sexual violence against Greta Thunberg. It's ugly as hell and can be condemned, but probably protected.
By the way, I got to commend you on your ability to bounce around. Christine, I'm sorry.
Terry, I keep going back to, the famous Nazis marching through Skokie, Illinois, and the ACLU mm-hmm. defended their right to march, and they had the right to march. Once you get, and that's as hateful speech as you can possibly get, marching through a neighborhood where there were Holocaust survivors and saying, and they were neo-Nazis. But I think that we're talking about different environments here. We're on the one hand, we're talking about speech that is just butting up at the level of action and incitement. And on the other hand, we're talking about speech that's just really repellent, and it turns you off, and it doesn't add anything to the marketplace of ideas. Mm-hmm. I can't honor someone's opinion that Charlie Kirk deserved to die because of his opinion on the Second Amendment. That speech may be protected at law, but there is no, and I understand what Will is saying, but I'm not going to extend grace to that person who says that thing. it's a very situational subject, I think. It's a case-by-case situation. And yeah, Cherry, you're right. There should be rules. Every employer, from Starbucks and the baristas to the CEO of a Fortune 500 company, should have a list of do's and don'ts. This is the threshold beyond which you cannot fall if you want to continue to represent my organization.
Yeah. By the way, I want to bring in another caller. Kimberly from Collingswood is on the line. Kimberly, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
I just wanted to say that I disagree with this idea that the more people crack down, the less you have to say. I think we should become ungovernable. I think if everybody uses their right to speak, the numbers will overwhelm the system and it will stop. You know, there's a point at which you self-censor to the point where you give fascists power. And I strongly disagree with this idea of not saying anything. I think if people speak out more, that they'll find that there are other people who actually agree with them. It's that, you know, that when you go into a meeting and one person has the courage to say something and people come up later, I'm glad you said that because that's what I've been thinking. That's what we need to be doing.
Yeah, thank you. That's Kimberly from Collingswood. Kimberly's answer, Will, is more speech. That's the response. And I wonder what we need to do as a society to sort of stop the escalation of the speech and more speech and speech and more speech that goes to violence. How do you sort of build this marketplace of ideas that, you know, Christine mentioned that we're all talking about here without it going to a place where people get killed or beat up or their place is destroyed or doxxed because of their opinions?
Yeah, that's the conversation I kind of wish we were having instead of terminations and firings and calls from on high for more action like that or crackdowns on political opponents. You know, whatever you think of Charlie Kirk, and he had his supporters and his detractors, and both of them will make cases. My organization is not going to, you know, litigate and call balls and strikes there. But again, he was somebody who would listen to, maybe provocatively, maybe as a means to an end, whatever. He would listen to other views. And if we were still having that conversation, the conversation that we were initially having on Wednesday about somebody who galvanized a movement by talking to people he disagreed with and trying to convince people, that's one conversation. Instead, we're, you know, by Friday, we're talking about people getting fired, you know, and I think that to answer your good question, which is a question I struggle with every day, it's like kind of the operational question of, you know, what I've been doing for the last 20 years. I think that the only way through is by talking to people. We're all going to live with each other. There's not going to be anything where the other side finally shuts up or we've finally convinced everybody. To the last caller's point, it's not just becoming ungovernable. It's that there's no way to govern that anyways. There's never going to be an edict from the vice president or the president that finally convinces everybody. People are always going to disagree, so we got to learn to live with that.
I think there's an argument that floats around sometimes that we need to maybe fine-tune what we allow in this era where the technology that promotes and permits speech has changed. So people look at the Second Amendment and say when, you know, they wrote the Second Amendment, they could not have imagined AR-15s. When they wrote the First Amendment, they could not have imagined social media and the echo chambers it creates and the way that that speech can lead to people doing truly heinous things in the world. What do you say back to folks, Will, who say the technology has changed? We've got to revisit what the First Amendment truly means.
The First Amendment hasn't changed with the advent of new technologies, right? We didn't update it when we had mass production of novels called penny dreadfuls, worried about those corrupting the youth, comic books, jazz music, motion pictures, sitcoms, video games. I mean, again, I'm 44. I remember, you know, look out, Nintendo is going to radicalize you, or the Columbine shooters were playing, you know, whatever, all that kind of stuff. I think what happens instead of government interaction, government fine-tuning, I think there's a societal fine-tuning. I told my kids, I got a third grader and fifth grader, I said, look guys, too much screens is going to make you weird and you're not going to be able to talk to other people. I mean, that's just like the basic. And I'm reading about this shooter and it all felt tragic to me. It sounded like somebody was really isolated. And, you know, I think what I'm pushing for again is more human connection, looking people in the eye and talking to them. Agree, disagree. But
not the government getting involved that process.
I get very worried. Imagine right now if you had the government getting
real
involved.
Real quick, Christine, you wanted to add before we start to wrap up?
I love what Will just said. I mean, when you tweet something at midnight, you're alone in your bed and you're not looking at another human being and you don't hear how that sounds to the rest of the world. We need to be with more people. We need to get off our phones. I say this as I'm on my cell phone. We need to actually connect with human beings. And listen, I have debates all the time with people that I disagree with, but I don't hate the person. Unfortunately, social media doesn't give you that entree into the lives of the people that you're speaking to. So you only get a chance to know their words and you can hate their words. If you know the people and you actually have these organic conversations, it may not be necessary to go and fire someone because they've said somebody deserved to die. I think we need to have more FaceTime. Yeah. The real FaceTime.
Well, as a show that promotes conversation, we think.
Yes.
I think that's a nice note to end on. And I want to thank both of you for being here. I know it's a tough topic to talk about, and lots of people have very strong opinions. Mm-hmm. We've shared some of those today. But let me thank you, Will Creeley, Legal Director at the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. Will,
thank
always
so
great
much.
To have you. And Christine Flowers, lawyer and columnist here in the city of Philadelphia. Christine, thanks for being on Studio 2.
Always great to be with you guys. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you for our very thoughtful callers today and all the folks who chimed in on YouTube and Facebook and emailed in. And thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes, Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, Al Banks and Tina Calique, engineer today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg. And Avi, I have to say, we're trying to create a forum, right? Where people who don't necessarily agree with each other can have civil conversation.
Yeah, and look, some people disagree with that as a goal. And then, like, I respect that they disagree with that as
a
goal.
I respect it too.
Yeah, so look, you're never going to find the perfect answer on all of this, but I'm glad we're having the conversation. And we hope you have another conversation with us tomorrow. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Thanks for joining us.